Okay, we are picking up with our study of Timothy, or the pastoral epistles, and we're toward the end of the first one, Timothy's first letter. And as we go through the letter, we see certain things going on. We just finished last time the chapter 4, and so he's going through telling Timothy all kinds of things of how to handle himself as the bishop of Ephesus. This area of Ephesus is a particular concern. We'll see it in this book and also in 2 Timothy. Because Paul, at one point in 2 Timothy, wants Timothy to leave there and come join him in Rome, but he's in prison. He's in chains. So I don't know what he wants him to do. But apparently Timothy doesn't leave Ephesus. As we saw in the introduction to the first letter, he ends up being martyred in Ephesus and later on. And so he's having he's struggling through Ephesus. It's also the place where St. John the Evangelist ended up in Ephesus, if you remember. And he wrote the book of Revelation there. Well, he scribed it. Jesus wrote it. He just said, hey, write down what you see, but what's interesting about the whole area there is that was St. John's diocese, that whole area. And Ephesus and Philadelphia and all these different cities, and they formed like a big horseshoe. And if you go around that horseshoe, those are all the cities that John wrote the letters to in the book of Revelation. And of course, Ephesus was where he was. Well, that whole region, in spite of all this effort on the part of the church to establish itself well there, it all fell to Islam. That whole area. So, understanding the dynamics of that, you can see why Timothy is struggling and having a problem in everything he's doing there, and why Paul is so concerned about making sure he does everything right. Because Paul is really hoping that they can turn the people of Ephesus around, and because he's getting a lot of opposition there, a lot of false teachers and stuff. So we just finished chapter 4, which is mostly focused on prayer, and then we'll get into, we're starting into chapter 5, and now he's talking about the duties we owe to other believers, besides Timothy, other people. And he kind of breaks them up into groups. He calls them old women, old men. Talks about proper widows. So he doesn't like young widows.
They're a temptation.
They are. He said young widows are a temptation. They got used to, being with a man, and all of a sudden they're going to want to go, interfere with a lot of things. And so he said, if they're young, get them married again. So we're going to see how he deals with some of this stuff as we go through chapter 5. He says, Scott's got a note here at the beginning of chapter 5. He says, Paul instructs Timothy on how to treat older and younger believers, widows, elders, and slaves. And he leads in with a reminder that every Christian under his care is a member of the spiritual family of Christ.
I have to tell you something funny. Excuse me, I won't say too much later. After John died, Father Gould used to sit in front of the church. He'd always holler over and say, oh, how you doing? I know I'm doing fine. He says, and after a while, he'd say, every week, you're doing good. I'm doing fine, believe me. He says, are the old men after you yet? And I said, you don't have to worry, Father. One is enough. it just came back. Because my grandmother, God bless her, she lived to be 94. And when my dear grandfather died, she was so good. She's a good lady. And she said, one is enough.
Yeah, that's funny. So he says, do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as you would a father. So have respect for your elders, but then try to teach them and exhort them to do the right kind of things. Treat younger men like brothers, older women like mothers, younger women like sisters, in all purity. So he's kind of given this, he looks at the whole congregation like a family. So he's telling you to treat people like as if they were part of your actual family, which is an interesting view. It says, honor widows who are real widows. And I thought that was interesting. Okay, you know, when I first saw that, I said, well, what's a false widow? You know, if these are real widows. But he says, honor women who are real widows. By that, he means the older ones. You know, they've done their thing with their husbands for a lot of years and all, and now they're older. So he calls them real widows. The young ones, they're ready to go tromping through the grapevines again, so they're not really, you know, real widows. So he says, honor widows who are real widows. If a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn their religious duty to their own family and make some return to their parents. In other words, if they have a big family, let the family take care of them. Don't you take responsibility, or don't assume the responsibility that the church has to take care of them. Because we got a lot of other people we do have to take care of. Mm-hmm. So if they've got a big family, let them take care of them. He says, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. That also goes back to the Jewish laws. In the Jewish law, if a woman was a widow, became a widow, then her children were obligated to care for her. The oldest son first, and then so on down the line. They were obligated under Jewish law to take care of the mother. And that's why it's funny when people try to say that Mary had a bunch of children, but yet on the cross Jesus, you know, says he gives her to John. That would be a huge violation of Jewish law to do that, because her other children would have to take care of her, you know. And so it's funny. And St. Ignatius of Antioch, he was the third bishop of Antioch. Peter was first, and then Ignatius. Well, he was a good friend of the Holy Family, and he was a direct disciple of St. John. And, of course, the Blessed Mother lived with St. John, so when he was working with Ignatius, Ignatius was there all the time. Well, there's a letter at the Vatican, it's a very short letter, from Ignatius of Antioch to the Blessed Mother. And he doesn't just say, hey, Mary, I'm coming to see you. He says, Holy Mother, ever virgin. Ever virgin, Holy Mother of God. Is how he addressed her. He didn't just say, hey, Mary. And then he said, I'm coming to the neighborhood in a while. I'm going to stop by and see you, you know, etc. Just a little short letter. But the way his salutation was the recognition, even in the first century, that she was the ever virgin Mother of God.
You would think they would bring that to our attention through the centuries to verify that doctrine.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing that that's there.
Yeah. It's a little short letter.
I was talking to, we had a Pentecostal friend who used to go to our Bible study group for years in Long Island, and we never knew why she came. The only hang-up was sort of Mary.
Right.
And I wish
that's
I
for
had,
so many of
that's
them.
That's so convincing.
Yes,
to have the letter.
Yeah,
it's amazing that we never heard
it's
that.
Really, yeah, it's funny they don't.
And it's back in the first century from somebody who actually knew her.
Right.
You know, it wasn't somebody later on who said, well, our doctrine says this and such. Mm-hmm. This is somebody who actually was acquainted with the family and knew her and was a direct disciple of St. John.
You know, at the Feast of the Annunciation, too bad that couldn't be put in, you know, when Father writes a letter, you know, with usually doctrine. Mm-hmm. That would be beautiful for at least more people.
Would you see what you could do about that?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. I'll call the Pope and see if I can get him to
see the letter. Yeah, to make that public.
Right. Yeah.
And this was the salutation in St. Ignatius of Antioch's letter. And by the way, all you Protestants that don't like Mary,
this is it.
This is it.
Yeah, I saw a copy of the letter. I used to have a copy of it on my computer.
Oh, my gosh.
But when I changed computers, I think I got lost because I can't find it anymore. But it's a real short little letter. The importance of the letter is the salutation, not the content of the letter.
And what do you think the salutation was again? Holy?
He says, says, Ever Virgin, Holy Mother of God. So he recognized her perpetual virginity and that she was the Mother of God. Which is kind of hard if she had seven or eight other kids.
Yeah. Right.
A little hard to be a perpetual virgin if you have that many kids, right?
That's right. That's
yes.
Right.
Yeah, all of us who have kids know that that would be very difficult.
Yes, okay. Profound.
So he's going on here about honoring widows who are real widows. And if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn their duty to their own family. For this is acceptable in the sight of God. So he's saying it's a good, God looks down favorably on people who take care of their elders. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, you're part of the same family, take care of each other. It says, she who is a real widow and is left all alone has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. And Scott Hahn's got a note here that kind of a widow that doesn't really have all this family and all, it's like Anna in the temple, in the Gospel of Luke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, she was married for several years and then she was a widow for a lot of years, but she lived in the temple. Mm-hmm. And the church took care of her, or the temple took care of her. You know, so. And he says, widows has special needs in ancient society where no economic or government programs were in place to assist them. And also back then, you know, women were not allowed to own property and that kind of thing. You know, they were kind of,
destitute.
You know, all the property went to the men. It was a very patristic society. Unlike today, it was a very patristic society. They should have learned lessons from the elephants, right?
They should have.
Which is a matriarchal society.
The elephants, yes.
First, never thought of that.
Yeah. Learn how to snort with the big horn, you know. And stuff. So Paul advises different support systems for different circumstances. He says the widows with a surviving family should be cared for by the family. Older widows without family or wealth are to receive material support from the local church. Younger widows are advised to remarry, lest their energies and idle time be spent in unwholesome conduct and conversation.
What a euphemism.
You can't trust these women, you know. I mean, you know. So Paul's got some interesting ideas about women. He
yes,
really does. Yeah.
It's one of the older ones,
kind of,
too.
It's kind of funny.
But Paul was the one that said not to marry, right? Isn't that one of the
That's what's
other
funny,
one of his letters?
Yes,
yeah.
He said,
yeah.
Don't
well,
marry.
That was when he thought the second coming was right around the corner.
Mm. So in these letters, he no longer thinks.
Yeah. Well, he sort of thinks he's in 2 Timothy, he's kind of getting away from it.
Okay. Oh, we're in 1 Timothy. Right.
We're still at the end of 1 Timothy, yeah. We're in chapter 5 now.
Five, yeah. Finally found it. Sorry. I didn't know.
Okay. So Paul's instructing Timothy how to treat the older and younger believers. So he goes through what we just covered here. So he says, she who is a real widow and is left alone, you know, needs to be taken care of. He says, command this so that they may be without reproach. So don't look down on somebody who's a real widow. The ones without a family. You know, it's I don't know why he chose to use that kind of terminology, because they're all real widows, you know, if their husband died. But he's making that kind of distinction, and that's kind of
well,
weird.
It's because he says the one who is self-indulgent is dead while she lives.
Yeah.
The one who is self-indulgent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But you know, isn't it instructive for us?
Or could it be that it was trying to
It's instructive for us, too. We are
real widows. Real widows are the women who cannot anymore provide for themselves.
Right. We believe that.
Ladies, Alan from the Philippines is trying to contribute something for us, so let's listen. Try that again, Alan, if we're all talking.
Sorry. I know, it's always fun to hear them in the background.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking maybe he said that because his point of view was probably real widows are those women who don't have children and cannot provide any more for themselves. Probably.
Right, exactly.
They don't have that chance anymore.
That's right.
So the younger ones, they can still have families, and like you said, Uh-huh. And so the real widows are the ones that Timothy should prioritize.
Right, and he does. And that's exactly what Paul's telling him. You know, watch out for the ones who are real widows and take care of them. And so it says, so he tells Timothy, command this. Command it to who? Command it to the congregation so that they understand what the rules are. So they understand their obligations and stuff like that. It says, command this so that they may be without reproach. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, especially for his own family, he has disowned the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So if you don't take care of your family, that's not a good thing. So there's a lot of Jewish influence in these rules, you know. Then he says, let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. And she must be well attested for her good deeds as one who has brought up children, shown hospitality, washed the feet of the saints, relieved the afflicted, afflicted, and devoted herself to doing good in every way. So it talks about the conduct of a good widow.
What does he mean? Let her be enrolled.
Enrolled. That's a good point here. Scott Hahn's got a note on that too. He's got notes on all this good stuff. He says, let's see, 5, 6.
Nine.
He talks about she who is a real widow and is left alone has set her hope on God and continues the supplications and prayers night and day, whereas she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. And Scott says, what do you mean by dead there is spiritually dead, spiritual lifeless. Okay. If she's self-indulgent, she's only thinking about herself all the time. And of course, look at almost everybody in today's society. They're all looking for themselves, right? That's the whole economy. And so enrolled means either added to a list of widows who qualify to receive assistance or registered among an organized group of widows committed to prayer and works of service. So enrolled is either the parish takes care of you or there's a group of other widows and stuff that will also take you under their wing and take care of you. And then you start participating with them. They provide for your needs and you help other people and stuff like that. It's kind of like the Legion of Mary for just widows.
Yeah.
You know. It says the character expected of these women is comparable to that of a prospective bishop or deacon. The conduct. What did the bishops and deacons do? They took care of people. You know, they helped them in the faith. They helped them take care of their physical needs and everything else. So he said, let a widow be enrolled if she's not less than 60 years old. If she's less than 60 years old, she's one of those young chicks. And you gotta watch out for them, you know. He said, but refuse to enroll younger widows. For when they grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry. And so they incur condemnation for having violated their first pledge. Okay. He doesn't have a high...
Their husbands are already dead, so they're not married. So how are they violating their first pledge?
Right.
I'd be tempting the wrong people. Some other married men.
But he said if they're good... They'll, you know, they're somebody who has brought up children, shown hospitality, and washed the feet of the saints. I thought washing the feet of the saints was kind of a strange thing. Now, Jesus did that at the Last Supper, if you remember. And he's got a note on washing the feet, too. He's got notes on all this stuff. He says, an act of hospitality common in societies where sandals are worn and dusty roads are traveled on foot. So when somebody would come into your house, as a courtesy, you would provide a foot washing for them so that they could get the dust off their feet. And you remember one of the other Gospels that says, you know, if somebody doesn't treat you right, shake the dust from their house off your feet and then go on and leave. So there's this this cultural thing about the dust on your feet from where you are.
And wasn't it when Mary Magdalene visited the house and Jesus rebuked, I forget his name, who didn't wash his feet?
Mm-hmm. That wasn't Mary Magdalene.
Mommy?
That wasn't Mary Magdalene.
Oh, it doesn't say who it is, does it?
It doesn't say.
Oh, yeah.
It does not say who it is.
Sinner.
It just says,
sorry.
A sinner.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
Everybody assumes it's Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's in chapter 7 of the Gospel of Luke. And it's this nice little thing. Now, that whole account is very, very interesting. Because it's a real treatise on on virtue. Now she says she's a sinner, but think of the virtues that had to be operative in her for her to do what she did. First of all, she's a sinner, comes in off the street. Who knows what her sin is? All kind of speculation goes on about that, but they never say. But she crashes the party of a Pharisee. She walks right into his house without being invited. Think of the courage that had to take. And then the humility. You know, she sits at the feet of Christ and doesn't say a word and just washes his feet with her tears and the ointment and dries them with her hair. And so that whole account, you know, and Jesus forgives her sin, of course. You go to the Gospel of John, chapter 11, first sentence in the Gospel of John, he says that Mary of Bethany was the woman who washed Jesus' feet and dried them with her hair. Hmm. So he identifies who she was.
But Luke does not.
That's good. Now I know.
So,
but isn't Mary of Bethany the same as Mary Magdalene?
No, Magdalene was not a name. It's where she's from.
It's where she's from.
It's Mary of Magdala.
Some people
and Mary of
Bethany. Oh,
yeah. Mary of
Bethany.
Yeah, people think Magdalene is her name.
No,
but it's just where she's from. It's like people think Jesus Christ was his name. Like it was Joseph Christ and Mary Christ and Jesus Christ, you know. It's a title. It's the title of the Anointed One. Jesus the Christ, not Jesus Christ. But that whole thing was a kind of interesting thing. And so you go to John, you find out who she really was. She was the good friend of Jesus by that time. He not only forgave her sins, but then befriended the entire family. And her brother Lazarus was the one that he rose from the dead.
Okay. Thank you for clearing
up all
these
things.
I learned a lot about widowhood.
Yeah, this is a very interesting letter. You know, you learn all kind of good things. Learn all kind of stuff from this letter. So he's talking about these widows here. He said, but refuse to enroll the younger widows, for when they grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry. I don't know why growing wanted against Christ leads to a desire to marry.
They just forget about their spiritual life.
Yeah, but why not just love somebody and then want to get married? Mm-hmm. I don't understand why you have to be wanton against Christ in order to want to get married again. Mm-hmm. That didn't
make any
sense. And
why he would recommend that they get married again if he wants the best for them.
Well, he does. He recommends.
Right. But why would he do that if that is the answer that he's saying happens when they grow wanton against Christ?
Well,
it seems confusing.
But growing wanton is kind of a negative thing on
very
somebody,
much
you know?
So. Yeah.
You know, I don't see why he couldn't assume that they were good, holy women who met somebody and felt attracted to him and decided to get married again.
You know, I had a thought, but it could be, you know, from left field. All these young widows are going out, but I'll say it politely. Maybe they're fooling around with all the guys that go out with
them.
Maybe
it's self-evident
He says when their sensuality, this is just another translation, their sensuality, for when their sensuality estranges them from Christ. So when they're really just eager to remarry, to be with a guy, that or just... Maybe that's not their path in life to be. Yes, maybe that's not their path in life to be like Anna in the temple.
Right.
To be married again and
Especially if they're young, you know.
So if that's what they are, then let them go marry.
Yeah.
I guess.
So I just found it interesting the way Paul worse this whole thing.
Will incur condemnation for breaking.
It's like he's scared to death of women, you know.
Don't you think that culturally that was huge at that time?
Well, it was a cultural thing, yeah. But you know, widows got remarried back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was nothing wrong with that.
Wasn't the brother supposed to take on the widow? The husband had a brother.
Yeah.
The brother was supposed to take.
Under Jewish law, yeah.
By Jewish law.
Yeah.
You know? So really, he provided for all of that.
Yeah. And even if the brother already had a wife, he was supposed to do that, you know?
Oh, really? Supposed to have two? Oh, I didn't know that.
And so, you know, in the church now, they just want you to have one. Mm. And so that law would not apply. Mm. So anyway, Paul's worried about these brazen young widows, you know? He's got to watch them like a hawk because they'll lead everybody else into sin. Can't trust women.
You can't.
Okay.
There's lots of them around.
He says, besides that, he's really down on his people.
Besides the fact that they violated their first pledge,
they learned to be idlers, gadding about from house to house, and not only idlers, but gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not.
That's what we do.
That's right. Yeah. It's yeah. You know, it's a very negative view of young widows, you know?
I think he has a problem with women.
So I'm kidding.
That's why they reject the Bible. Things like this.
Today,
people are reading.
Yeah. So I would much rather think of a young widow as somebody who is still anxious to have a life together with somebody else.
Right.
You know, and what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So I would have younger widows marry their children, rule their households, and give the enemy no occasion to revile us. Now, they have to be under 60 years old to be a young widow. So they're 59 years old, they qualify. So get married again and have children?
Well, that might be hard.
That might be a little hard.
Right? That might be difficult.
Well, that's what he says here. Have the younger widows marry, bear children, rule their households, and give the enemy no occasion to revile us. For some have already strayed after Satan. They're going after Satan. He thinks they're chasing Satan.
This makes you very judgmental. If you would read this, you would look at other people we're not supposed to.
This is Paul sitting on the airplane talking to the reporters.
Exactly.
Which tells you, it kind of gives you an idea why Paul never got married.
That too.
I think he was afraid of women.
Yeah. Thank God the women were safe.
Yeah. Well, and he said he's the one that said earlier in the book that they weren't supposed to speak at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So he says, if any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her assist them. So if you're a woman and you've got a relative who's a widow, then you want to assist. Back to the first thing about
family taking care of family.
Okay. Let the church not be burdened so that it may assist those who are real widows. So if you're a real widow, hi.
Hi. Good morning. I need to sneak by you, my dearest.
Oh, okay. Do you have a cord?
I'm skinny. I ain't that skinny.
So he says, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. So he's talking about the elders. The elders are like the presbyters. Okay? And if they rule well, let them be considered worthy of double honor. So you honor them.
But weren't presbyters at one time priests too?
Yeah, they are. They are.
Oh, they are. I was wondering that too. They are priests.
Yeah, he's got this hierarchy chart down here. It's called the threefold pastoral ministry. Mm-hmm. Under the temple law, the Jewish law, you had the high priest, the priest, and the Levites.
The Levites
were like the presbyters, the day-to-day priests who took care of the temple. The synagogue had the ruler of the synagogue, the board of elders, and the servants. So that's different from the temple. Okay. The church, you have the bishop, the presbyters or priests and deacons. And they kind of equate, in one of Scott's notes here, they kind of equate the presbyter with the elder. And they was kind of confused and used interchangeably, but eventually it all...
I am at the gift shop now, and I have a rosary with me. I'll see you later. Bye-bye.
Eventually it all kind of got solidified. Uh-huh. I think it was kind of loose in terminology back then, but they got kind of solidified. And so you shall not muzzle, it says, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages.
I got your rosary, you owe $5.
So he says, you honor those who in preaching and teaching, for scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox, and the laborer deserves his wages. Where did that come from? Yeah,
really.
He says,
these are
two quotes from Deuteronomy and the Gospel of Luke. You shall not muzzle. This is a quote from Deuteronomy 25:4. For Paul, permitting animals to eat while they work carries a hidden significance now revealed by the Gospel, so that what is true for oxen is even truer for ordained elders. In other words, while they're working, you take care of them, you feed them. Mm. It's odd that he compares elders to an ox, but the idea is that it comes from Deuteronomy, and that's why he does it. So their work entitles them to a share in the community's food and provisions. That also goes back to the Jewish law with the Levites. You remember the tribe of Levi was not allowed to own any property in the land of Canaan. And the rest of the tribes had to provide for them and take care of them. And so they were cared for, just like we do with our priests today. You know, we don't expect them to go out and be a bank president or something. You know, we want them here taking care of the church, so we provide for their needs. And that's the same thing he's talking about here. You shall not muzzle. It says, for Paul, permitting animals to eat. It says, the allegorical meaning of this Old Testament passage corresponds to the literal meaning of the New Testament passage that follows, laborers deserve their wages. That's a quote from Luke chapter 10, verse 7, where Jesus insists that ministers of the word have a right to a fair compensation for their preaching. And so he's showing the continuity of the Old Testament to the New Testament. In other words, Christianity is a continuation of the Jewish faith, the Jewish revelation. And in the beginning, a lot of the Jews felt that's what the Christian faith was going to be, that you would become Jewish for them and Christian, you know.
Right.
So there was this feeling that there was not a real separation between the two. Nowadays, we don't see that. In fact, Roy Shulman, when he wrote his book, Salvations from the Jews, it's a really, really good book if you haven't read it yet. But in there, he talks about how he was a Jew. He was a Jewish scholar, and he converted first to an evangelical church. And he said they wanted me to reject everything from my Jewish heritage. And he said, I'm Jewish, you know. And so then he ended up becoming Catholic. And he said, when I joined the Catholic Church, I finally realized what it meant to be a Jew. He said, I became a fulfilled Jew. And that was an interesting observation, because he said there was no separation. There's a continuity between the Jewish faith and the expectations of the Messiah and what we have in Christianity. That's why we read Old Testament readings at Mass, is that continuity.
And it's nice, like, if they become converts even, they don't have to reject.
Right.
That's right.
It's so beautiful.
And that's,
right?
And that's what he said.
Yeah.
And there's another Jewish lady I just heard.
That became a nun.
Yeah.
Rosalind DeMoss.
Rosalind DeMoss, yeah. Oh, yeah, she was. She made a comment on one of her tapes. She said, "You cannot be more Jewish than to be Catholic."
And Edith Stein.
Yeah.
Look at her name.
That's true.
You know? Mm-hmm.
So all these things. So then he talks about how to treat the elders and stuff. Mm-hmm. He says, "Never admit any charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses." And that kind of goes back to Jewish law, too, if you remember.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just convict somebody on the testimony of one witness. You remember Susanna?
Mm-hmm.
And
the
guys, and the thing with Daniel and that whole trial?
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. Okay. So a lot of what Paul's talking about here, these rules of conduct, have their foundation in Jewish practice, Jewish customs. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. What does that sound like? Sounds like what Jesus taught us in the Gospel of Matthew. It says if somebody commits a sin, you go to them privately and you talk to them. Mm. If they don't want to listen to you, you bring back two or three witnesses.
Yeah.
You let them talk to them. If they don't want to listen, you bring it to the church.
Mm.
If they don't want to listen to the church, you treat them like a tax collector or a Gentile.
Except now we're supposed to tolerate everybody.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what, you know, what Paul is saying here is kind of the same thing Jesus said in the gospel.
Reprimand publicly.
Yeah.
We could use a few reprimands publicly.
I know. That's what we don't do anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, at the Carmelite meeting yesterday, how strange, you can always see connections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Somebody come up to me who runs another group, you know, a formation, and she said, not that she was tattling, because we can't talk like that. I do the newcomer group. And she said, this man is very passive-aggressive at the group. And she said, I said, well, does it cause a problem? You know, with the, there's a lot in her group. And she said, well, it's confrontational now.
Yeah.
And I said, ooh. And the rule of the Carmelites is, you know, if you're in formation and there's any little red flag, you got to check it out with the council, and they decide who's moving up to the next group.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a lovely man, believe me. But she's noticing this.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, I have to work this out and, you know, see how maybe the council can speak to him.
Yeah.
Before, because I think the moving up is in October. So that would be the next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's a delicate issue.
Yeah,
maybe she should read Paul's letter to Timothy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he might get some hints as to how to behave.
Yeah.
It says, in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without favor, doing nothing from partiality. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands, nor participate in another man's sins. Keep yourself pure. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands. He's talking about the same thing you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's saying, don't be so quick to ordain somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, find out if they if they should. He says, do not be hasty. Scott Hahn's got a note on that, too. Okay. He says, Timothy is told to screen candidates for pastoral ministry before ordaining them by the sacramental imposition of hands. Otherwise, the hurried promotion of immature or poorly formed believers might have ruinous consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
And isn't that what we do today?
Mm-hmm.
If a man wants to become a priest, we first do a first level discernment with the vocations director, and then all the while they're in seminary, they have a spiritual director who's constantly evaluating whether they really have a genuine vocation or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, they say, well, we don't think you should stay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it depends on how good the vocations director is in getting them there in the first place. And so we've had some very good vocations directors in our diocese, thank goodness. Father Gould was doing that for a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the one who brought my son in.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Mm.
And then he gives him some good advice. He says, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. So he doesn't say drink a lot of wine. He says just a little wine. Because apparently, according to Scott Hahn's notes, he's got another one on that too. He says, Timothy's fragile health was a concern to Paul. He is advised to consume wine in moderation and so benefit from its medicinal properties. Wine can sometimes offset the uncomfortable effects of drinking impure water. Think of the water they drank back then.
Oh, yeah.
They would just dip things into a stream, and then it looked pure. They had no way to purify. They didn't have bleach. They didn't have any way to purify the water, kill the germs, you know. And, you know, animals were doing whatever they do near the streams and everything else.
No grittas.
And so you never know how pure the water really is, even if it looks clear. And so sometimes Timothy would have these ailments. And so Paul's advising him to, because wine, what? It's got alcohol in it. It's going to kill the germs. And so he says, drink a little wine to help you get counter the effects of this bad water. Because they didn't have microscopes back then. They couldn't, had no way to look at the water to see if, you know, it was pure or not.
I have to think of my mom. She lived to be 98, God bless her. And she'd always have a little glass. You know, she lived with us, like, I don't know, 25 years maybe. And the glass would be this big. And she could, you know, drink it. It was red wine. And then the older she got, of course, it went down to like this. But she lived to be 98 and died of natural causes. And I said, you know.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
A little bit of red wine.
Exactly. Yeah. I was thinking that when I read that little
wine. That's what I keep telling my wife. We drink her red wine every night. So then he talks about men's deeds, false teaching, and true riches. One of the things that Paul is very concerned about in Ephesus are these people, two of them in particular, who are going around giving these false teachings. Mm-hmm. We talked about it earlier in the letter. And he's still got that on his mind because he knows he's not there. He plans to come, but apparently he never does go back to Ephesus because he gets arrested, you know, and stuff. And he's very concerned about how Timothy is going to deal with these guys that are given this false teaching and all. So he cautions him twice about it. He said, the sins of some men are conspicuous, pointing to judgment, but the sins of others appear later. So he's helping him learn how to watch people and discern people. Because sometimes they will look really good on the outside at first, but then when you get to know them better, you find out what a crumb they are. You know?
That's right.
And it's like the parable of the wheat and the tares in the gospel. You know, the weed grows up, looks just like wheat. You can't tell the difference. You don't find out later until you find out that the wheat is bearing the fruit and the weeds are not. Same sort of thing here. So don't be so quick to make a final judgment on anybody. Let them show you who they really are and then make a decision. He says, so also good deeds are conspicuous, and even when they are not, they cannot remain hidden. You'll always find out who's doing good deeds because word gets around. You know, what did Jesus do? Every time he cured somebody, he said, don't tell anybody, and a person would go off and tell the whole town, right? same thing. It says, let all who are under the yoke of slavery regard their masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be defamed.
That's another one of those that they use against the Bible because they're saying it's approving of slavery.
Yeah, that was the culture back then, you know? Scott's got a note on that.
I mean, yesterday on TV, I heard this black commentary, and she would not be a Christian even though she grew up because of that.
Yeah. It says slavery. The conversion of slaves and their masters in the early church raised questions of how these relationships should be handled by believers. Paul insists that slaves must honor their masters and that masters must respect their slaves, lest Christians acquire a reputation for being either insubordinate or inhumane. Mm-hmm. Without approving the institution of slavery as such, he is stressing that every station in life provides opportunities to serve the Lord. So, I mean, they had slavery back then. We still have slavery today. There's some places in Africa where they're you're doing slavery, mm-hmm. one tribe against another. You know, it's mm-hmm. It's not a nice thing, but it happens. But he's talking about people that are even if they're slaves, they should act like a Christian should act mm-hmm. toward their masters. And if both the master and the slave are Christians, then they should treat each other with great respect. So let's see, those who have believing masters, which means the master and the slave are both Christians, mm-hmm. those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brethren. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their service are believers and beloved. So do the job that you are assigned mm-hmm. and do it the best way you can. Mm-hmm. And that's true for all of us too. Mm-hmm. If you're in the workforce, you should do the best job you can, not just slip yeah. off all day. Don't retire in place, you know. Keep working. Teach and urge these duties. So it's one more time Paul's telling Timothy to teach the congregation what these rules are, so that they all know how they're supposed to behave. Don't just keep it to yourself. If anyone teaches otherwise and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching which accords with godliness, he is puffed up with conceit. He knows nothing. He has a morbid craving for controversy and for disputes about words, which produce envy, dissensions, slander, base suspicions, and wrangling among men who are depraved in mind and bereft of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. So your buddy that you're talking about should read that passage, okay?
Right, that's...
So don't look at godliness as a way to gain. Mm-hmm. It's not about how much wealth you acquire, it's what you believe and how much you love God. It all centers on love. There is great gain in godliness with contentment, for we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. He's got another note on that. It says, recall similar statements you find in Job and Ecclesiastes, where Job says, you know, I came in with nothing, going out with nothing, blessed be the name of the Lord. Yeah. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and hurtful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. What did Jesus say? Where your heart is, that's where your treasure will be also. So if the people that's totally focused on becoming rich, they don't pay any attention to God or becoming a good person. All they care about is how much wealth they have. And then he says, for the love of money is the root of all evils. Have you heard that before?
Yeah. Right?
Okay. But the important thing is he doesn't say money is the root of all evils. The love of money is the root of all evils. And guess what? Scott's got a note on that too. It says the love of money. Paul reproves not the wealthy, but the lovers of wealth. So dangerous is the allurement of riches that he warns in the strongest possible terms against piling it up for ourselves. Unless we become poor in spirit, the downward pull of money and material possessions will eventually lead to destruction. What evils are caused by wealth? There are frauds, robberies, miseries, enmities, contentions, battles. Take away the love of money and you put an end to war, conflict, enmity, strife, and contention. So says St. John Chrysostom in his homilies on 1 Timothy.
I'm thinking of the widow who put in the one penny.
Right.
Yeah.
Which wasn't greedy.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically what he's saying here is that if you win the lottery, don't just keep it all to yourself. You know, use it for good. Mm. Share it. I mean, who needs $400 million, you know? Yeah. You know, a couple of million would be perfectly happy, you know, and then use the rest for the... pay off the building renovation or something. You
yeah,
know?
The office.
Yeah. I see. Love money. Okay. See, it is through this craving, this love of money, that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced their hearts with many pangs. Because you really become kind of miserable.
Yes.
Because your life becomes very empty. So all you care about is a thing instead of a person or a God. Mm-hmm. You focus on a thing. It's like Midas.
Yeah.
You just wanted a bag of gold. That's it. So the good fight of faith. But as for you, man of God, shun all this. Aim at righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, and gentleness. Fight the good fight of the faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called when you made the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. He's got to know the good confession, if you know what that means. Probably Timothy's profession of faith enunciated at his baptism. Paul is urging him to live out his baptismal promises to the full. So you confess your faith at baptism. Remember the things they go through mm-hmm. the list, you know, do you renounce Satan, do you renounce this, blah, 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 and so on. Okay. In the presence of God who gives life to all things, and of Christ Jesus, who in his testimony before Pontius Pilate made the good confession. He talks about Jesus saying the same, telling Pilate, you know, you don't have any power unless it's given to you from above. And then Pilate tries to figure out, you know, what is truth and all that whole thing of the Passion. It's kind of interesting. This refers to Jesus' testimony to the truth at his trial before Pontius Pilate. And this will be made manifest at the proper time by the blessed and only Sovereign, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This is a reference to God's superiority over every earthly ruler. It's also a hymn, King of Kings and Lords of Lords. I forget who sang it. Who alone has immortality and dwells in unapproachable light, whom no man has ever seen or can see. To him honor and eternal dominion. Amen. And then he finishes off verse 17. He says, as for the rich of this world, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on uncertain riches, but on God, who richly furnishes us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good deeds, liberal and generous, thus laying up for themselves a good foundation for the future so that they may take hold of the life which is life indeed. In other words, life in heaven. So he says, if you're rich, fine, but don't be haughty about it. Be humble and don't set all your hopes on your money. Set your hopes on God. So if you have a lot of riches, share them. Do good deeds.
Biden says.
So personal instructions and benediction. As O Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you. Avoid the godless chatter and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. For by professing it, some have missed the mark as regards the faith. Grace be with you. When he's talking about this, he said the contradiction, but it's falsely called knowledge. He's talking about Gnosticism here. Because the Gnostics believed that you gained salvation by this kind of secret knowledge that only they have. The perverse thing about that, in my mind, is that it says only those who are intelligent enough to understand their secret knowledge can be saved. So what about all the people that are not that smart? Or people who have mental deficiencies of some kind? Are they hopelessly not able to be saved?
But they talk about Gnosticism through the centuries, and they seem to give it different definitions.
Yeah.
confusing.
Yeah.
But that's the original, right?
That's his, okay. Yeah. That's the idea of secret knowledge. Mm-hmm. But some of the Gnostics had weird beliefs, too. Paul mentions that either in this letter or in his second letter, I forget which, that they believed the materialism was bad. Mm-hmm. And so that that the body was bad, only the spirit was good. Mm-hmm. And so they rejected marriage, they rejected a lot of food and stuff. Basically, they forsook marriage and starved themselves to death, thinking they were doing a good thing.
Mm. So they didn't become Essenes, though.
No.
Because that was another sect that did that.
Right. So, you know, it just shows how horrible Satan is and how he can twist the minds of people unbelievably in all these things. It's just really...
It's like against common sense, you know, when you start to think of things, but they're so blinded. I
mean, well, it's also putting your dependence on yourself instead of on God. Because if I want to get the secret knowledge, then I've got it. You know, I acquired it. It wasn't given to me.
Yeah.
You know, and Paul makes mention of several places that the only thing we have that's worth anything is what is given to us by the grace of God. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing we have to really focus on all the time, because you can't take it with you, right? Ain't no hearses with a U-Haul trailer behind them. Okay? So, that's... And then he finishes off the letter with grace be with you, which is kind of interesting, because the whole letter was to Timothy personally. Mm-hmm. This last phrase here, it says, the best Greek manuscripts have you... It says, grace be with you, you in the plural. Since the best Greek manuscripts have you in the plural, many have reasoned that the letter, while primarily sent to Timothy, was also intended to be read before the Ephesian congregation. Mm-hmm. So he sent the letter to Timothy, but he expected Timothy to read all a part of it to the congregation.
Yeah. Because it's rules that apply to all of them.
Yeah. Because he covers all the different classes of society there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
The old men and the young widows and the old widows and the whatever and stuff. Tells them how to behave.
I'm conscious of being a widow. I never use that word.
You're the good kind.
I'm telling you.
Yeah. So it is 10:29. So before we, rather than try to start 2 Timothy... Now we'll just quit for the day and pick up 2 Timothy next time.
And, which book of Scott's is that again?
It's called the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible
New
Testament.
That's good. That's a good book with all the footnotes.
Yeah, it's got tremendous footnotes
Ignatius
in it.
Catholic,
it's a study Bible. Yeah. It's got each page. Oh. It's got the text of the scripture on the top and the whole bottom half of the page is all footnotes.
Yeah, that's good.
It's really good. It's called the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible New Testament, second edition, RSV.
Yeah.
So it's really good. Anybody have any thoughts or comments on
we made them already.
Oh, yeah, we talked earlier.
Yeah, we made them already.
made our thoughts known.
Okay. Well, we will... We will stop here then, and we'll pick up next time. And I did talk to the maintenance guy this morning, and he said he thinks the internet is working in Mercy Hall. So after September, when October comes around, we'll go back to Mercy Hall.
Okay.
I thought about staying here because it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
But the minute they start the renovation of the building, we got to get out anyway.
Oh, right.
So, October we'll go back there.
You know what I brought in? We used to talk about pictures of, you know, like guardian angels that came up. This was ages ago. I don't know what.